All taxpayers goes to Israel to kill children and kill women. For me, this money should go to create art, to create culture, to support artists, to build theaters, to build artistic and cultural organization all over the world, to save artists in China and Russia, even in US. I want this money not goes to create weapons. Americans, you are getting your picture in a way, not in a right way, because all this military support and all this military crazy support goes to change your pictures as a human. I believe our friends in America, we have the friends of the Freedom Theater in New York. They are Jewish and they are supporting us.
Ahmed, we have to leave it there.
Change the text.
Ahmed Tabassi, Artistic Director of Freedom Theater, just released by Israel, and Peter Schumann. Thank you.
KABU Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operation and programming of KABU in accordance with the requirements of the Communication Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KABU Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website at kabu.fm. The Policy and Governance Committee meets on the third Tuesday of March, June, September, and December at 6 p.m. This month's meeting will be held online through a public video conference. A public link and phone number to attend the meeting can be found on our website at kabu.fm. Please visit our website to verify if a meeting is being held.
KABU's end-of-year campaign is happening right now. We invite you to donate and become a member today. We have the full spectrum of ways to join. Go to kboo.fm/give or by texting KBOO to the number 44321. You can also mail a check to the station at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland. Cut through the clouds and make it rain to help us meet our $75,000 goal by December 31st.
Well, this is KBOO Portland. The time is 5:02. We'd like to thank the recent donors to KABU's end-of-year campaign. Thank you to Thomas J., Charles V., William M., and Jody D. Support KABU today, kabu.fm/give. Now, the KABU Evening News.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KABU Evening News.
Coming up on the KABU Evening News, Portland Jewish Voice for Peace activists shut down the Burnside Bridge Thursday, protesting in support of a ceasefire in Gaza.
Portland Commissioner Carmen Rubio unveils a plan to spend extra clean energy fund dollars and save PBOT from its budget shortfall.
And in national news, a judge awards nearly $150 million in damages to two Georgia election workers who were defamed by Trump attorney Rudy Giuliani.
Good evening. This is the KABU Evening News for Friday, December 15th, 2023. KABU is currently in our end-of-year campaign, and we'd like to urge you to become a member by going online to kboo.fm/give. I'm Josh Salem.
And I'm Michelle Coppola. On Thursday, activists from Jewish Voice for Peace, PDX, shut down the Burnside Bridge during rush hour in protest in support of a ceasefire in Gaza. From 3 to 6:30 p.m., activists closed the bridge to traffic, lighting a 12-foot-tall menorah on the eighth night of Hanukkah. Here are some sounds from the rally.
As Jews and other people united in the movement for a free Palestine, we are here today rising up with unprecedented numbers and moral clarity to say that there will be no business as usual as the U.S. is funding and abating a genocide. We are part of a nationwide JVP movement today, taking urgent action in 8 cities, on 8 bridges, on the 8th night of Hanukkah, calling for a ceasefire. Right. On this last night of Hanukkah, we remember the lessons from our Jewish ancestors who taught us the necessity to rise up against our oppressors by whatever means necessary. As Jews, we come from long legacies of resistance and resilience. Rededication is a theme of Hanukkah. So on this last night, we rededicate our lineage of resilience towards the struggle against genocide, against apartheid, against occupation. We light these candles, in a little bit, in commitment to Palestinian liberation. During Hanukkah, we have the tradition of putting our menorahs in the window as we light them each night. We do this as our ancestors have bravely and defiantly done so, even in the most heightened times of anti-Semitism, like during the Holocaust. The famous image of the menorah in the window in Germany across the street from a Nazi building with flags is such a powerful instance of showing that we are still here. Tonight, we bring the same moral courage as we light this menorah atop of one of Portland's most prominent bridges to say that we are not afraid as Jews to take action for Palestine.
Those were some of the sounds from the Jewish Voice for Peace rally on Thursday protesting for a ceasefire in Gaza.
Portland City Commissioner Carmen Rubio has plans to spend hundreds of millions of clean energy fund dollars across a few city offices, and it could mean saving the Bureau of Transportation from painful cuts. The Portland Clean Energy Fund raises money from a 1% tax on retail sales from large companies in the city. The funds go towards addressing climate change impacts on communities of color and other marginalized groups. It has continually raised more money than expected. Rubio unveiled plans to allocate $540 million in clean energy fund investments across 6 bureaus. Importantly, this includes the Portland Bureau of Transportation, or PBOT, which is facing a $32 million hole in their budget. Rubio's plans for PBOT would allocate over $100 million to the department for projects focused on walking and biking networks, LED streetlights, and upgrading the Portland streetcar fleet. The plan also carves out funds for energy efficiency upgrades through the Housing Bureau, plus funds to help low-income residents with their utility bills. It also puts $77 million towards tree planting and restoring natural area through the Bureau of Environmental Services. This would be over the course of 5 years. PBOT Communications Director Hannah Schaefer told Bike Portland in an email, quote, "We are currently assessing how this will impact our overall budget shortfall. We anticipate this funding will help us keep jobs and programs that otherwise would have been cut," end quote. The Portland Clean Energy Fund Committee will weigh in on the plan at their next meeting in January. If they like the idea, Portland City Council would vote to approve the plan before it is adopted.
Earlier this afternoon, a federal jury in Washington, D.C. awarded 2 Georgia election workers a total of $148 million in damages in a defamation lawsuit against former New York governor and Trump attorney Rudolph Giuliani. Ruby Freeman and her daughter Shay Moss sued Giuliani for defamation after he repeatedly accused them publicly of vote tampering in the 2020 presidential election. No evidence was presented at the time of Giuliani's claims or in court to support his accusations against the election workers. The Georgia Election Board, as well as the Trump administration's Department of Justice, cleared both Freeman and Moss of any wrongdoing. The New York Times reports that the jury awarded Ms. Freeman and Ms. Moss a combined $75 million in punitive damages, over $16 million each for compensatory damages and $20 million each for emotional suffering. As a result of Giuliani's false claims, Moss was forced to leave her job of 10 years. Freeman was forced to move from her home of 20 years. That was due to death threats and harassment, as well as abuse via phone, in public, and online. After the verdict, Freeman said, quote, "Today is a good day, but no amount of money can give me and my daughter back what we lost," end quote. Speaking to reporters afterwards, Giuliani was unrepentant about his prior statements and vowed to appeal.
Downtown Portland's famous Elk Statue Fountain will return. thanks to a $1.5 million budget approved by the Portland City Council this week. The statue, Portland's second oldest piece of public art, was originally put in place on Southwest Main Street between 3rd and 4th Avenue back in 1900. The elk was removed for public safety reasons after vandals damaged the monument during the protests of 2020. K2 News reports that the plan approved by the City Council will restore the stone carving and masonry around the statue itself and install a recirculating water fountain as well. No completion date has been announced at the time of the budget approval.
The White House continues to pressure House GOP members to pass aid for Ukraine. Senators are renewing calls for stronger gun safety laws on Sandy Hook's 11th anniversary. And New Jersey looks to boost voter participation. With more on those stories, it's Edwin J. Vieira with 2023 Talks.
Welcome to 2023 Talks, where we're following our democracy in historic times.
And they'll face more death and destruction to their families and their homeland. They need our help. And they need it right now, not after the eggnog.
National Security Council spokesman John Kirby is putting heat on House Republicans for holding up supplemental aid to Ukraine. On Thursday, Russian President Vladimir Putin said Western support for Kiev is weakening and peace will only come from Russia's imminent victory. Ohio Republican Congressman Dave Joyce says he hasn't seen any evidence President Joe Biden was corrupt as vice president. He did vote for the impeachment inquiry, but says he views it as an investigation.
I mean, I think that the evidence needs to be produced that people can make that determination in a whether it's there or whether it's not.
Joyce says impeachment has become politicized and has been abused in recent years. Vice President Kamala Harris is urging the administration to show more concern for Palestinian lives amidst the humanitarian crisis in Gaza. According to the New York Times, White House officials are telling their Israeli peers they should stop large-scale attacks in favor of targeted strikes, and Biden is becoming increasingly public in his criticism of how Israel is waging the war.
I want them to be focused on how to save civilian lives, not stop going after Hamas, but be more careful.
Yesterday was the 11th anniversary of the Sandy Hook school shooting. Democratic Connecticut Senator Chris Murphy is calling for stricter gun safety laws.
We just need to make a decision as a country as to whether we want to live in a world in which this carnage continues. This isn't an accident. It isn't bad luck. It's a choice.
Rudy Giuliani didn't take to the witness stand Thursday in his ongoing defamation trial brought forth by two Georgia election workers he accused of voter fraud. But he says he still might.
When I was a prosecutor, defense lawyers never told me if the guy was going to testify or not. So I sure as heck am not going to tell them whether I am or I'm not.
U.S. District Judge Beryl Howell has already ruled Giuliani is liable for defaming the poll workers. The trial now is to decide on damages. Some state lawmakers in New Jersey hope to boost turnout in primary elections by allowing 17-year-olds to vote if they turn 18 by the general election. Makari Vargas with the New Jersey Institute for Social Justice says voting is habit-forming, but even more so before the disruptions that come after high school.
Whereas if you introduce it while they're still in school, it becomes a part of their curriculum, a part of their civics education.
A bill to lower the voting age has passed the state House and awaits action in the Senate. 18 other states and Washington, D.C. have similar laws. Finally, another poll shows former President Donald Trump ahead of President Joe Biden in 7 key battleground states. The survey from Morning Consult and Bloomberg found voters favor Trump on the economy. I'm Edwin J. Vieira, filling in for Alex Gonzalez for Pacifica Network and Public News Service. Find our trust indicators at publicnewsservice.org.
3 teachers have filed a lawsuit over a Florida statute mandating specific pronoun usage requirements in schools, which they argue is discriminatory and anti-LGBTQ+. Tramell Gomes reports.
3 Florida teachers filed suit on Wednesday over a Florida statute they claim targets transgender and non-binary teachers for being themselves at work. The teachers, Katie Wood, A.V. Schwandes, and a Jane Doe, argue the statute, which falls under HB 1069, which bans instructions on sexual orientation and gender identity in kindergarten through 8th grade, also prohibits school employees and contractors from providing their pronouns to students if they do not correspond to their sex. Sam Boyd is an attorney at the Southern Poverty Law Center. He says plaintiff Katie Wood, a Hillsborough County High School math teacher, was hired at her school as a transgender woman, where she would normally write down Miss Wood on the chalkboard. That was until the law passed, and the school said she could no longer do that.
And so if a student calls her Mr., she's not allowed to say anything to them about that. The student, you know, asks whether she would prefer to be called Ms. Wood. She's not allowed to answer. You know, she has to sort of stay silent and misrepresent this basic aspect of her identity.
Officials at the Department of Education and the local school district named in the lawsuit have not yet commented on the case. However, Republican lawmakers with a supermajority argued that expanding the parental rights law was necessary to ensure the state's youngest students learn about adult topics such as sexual orientation and gender identity from their parents instead of at school. According to the complaint, the new law has stigmatized transgender and non-binary teachers, threatened their psychological well-being, and upended the respect that is owed to them as educators. Boyd says the pronoun law violates constitutional rights tied to sex discrimination, equal protection clauses, and free speech, among other things. And he hopes the court will see the way it restricts the freedoms of educators.
The State Board of Education issued regulations that make complying with this law a part of the standards of professionalism under the state, and that means that teachers' licenses can be revoked by the state if they violate the law.
This issue is also part of the same law that falls under the so-called book bans, which prohibits materials in schools that contain sexual conduct. Critics are worried its vague language could apply to valuable pieces of literature. This is Tramell Gomes for Florida News Connection.
You're listening to an end-of-year campaign edition of the KBOO Evening News. Our goal is to raise $75,000 by the time 2023 exits the building. We'd like to remind you that you can renew your KBOO membership or become a member at any time during this program by going online to kboo.fm/give. Stay tuned after this newscast for Counterspin, your look behind the headlines with fairness and accuracy in reporting. At 6, it's Rising Up with Sonali, and then at 7, it's Civic Cypher. Tonight's weather, cloudy, a low of 40. Tomorrow, also cloudy with a high of 49. Today in history, in 1973, the American Psychiatric Association votes 13-0 to remove homosexuality from its official list of psychiatric disorders. The quote of the day is from quantum physics pioneer Wolfgang Pauli, who said, "The deepest pleasure in science comes from finding an instantiation, a home for some deeply felt, deeply held image."
When the Native Act was passed in 2016, tribal leaders were hopeful it would stimulate tourism in their communities through federal funding. Some 7 years in, those funds have been slower to materialize than expected. With that story and more, it's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Indigenous community leaders held a lecture series in Washington, D.C. this week to discuss successes and federal partnerships to boost tourism, as well as a path forward to build on that success. But federal assistance that was expected nearly a decade ago is arriving slower than anticipated. For the Mountain West News Bureau, Dylan Samard reports.
When President Obama signed the Native Act in 2016, Native leaders were hopeful that it would stimulate a vibrant tourism industry in their communities. It got off to a good start. But Wizapan Little Elk Garriott says it tapered off within a year, and leaders want to get it started again. Garriott is with the Interior Department and a member of the Rosebud Sioux Tribe.
The Act, you know, continues to really have a strong mandate, and everyone is supportive. Tribes, Congress, and it's really about how can we implement and how can we continue to think about strengthening these efforts.
Garriott discussed long-term plans for getting federal agencies on board with the Native Act. It mandated that certain agencies make resources available for economic development surrounding tourism in indigenous communities. I'm Dylan Samard.
Many Alaska Natives are members of the Russian Orthodox Church and observe Christmas in early January with a seven-day celebration called Slavic or Slavy, which comes from the Russian word glory. For many this year, there will be something missing from the holiday, the presence of Father Michael Oleksa, who died in November at age 76. KMBA's Rhonda McBride knew him personally and shares a few of her memories.
Father Michael Oleksa was a priest, a teacher, scholar, historian, and much more. But the thread that ran through it all was his storytelling. And like many Alaskans, I have a favorite one to share from his time living in the southwestern Alaska village of Gweethluk, where he was studying for the priesthood and was invited on a muskrat hunt.
And we came home one afternoon with about a dozen muskrats. And the lady of the house, who was my Yupik teacher, Annabelle Olick, she was delighted. She skinned and gutted these muskrats. And then she set the table with washcloths as well as spoons. Now, I knew we were having soup, but the washcloths mystified me. I was soon to find out that those were for bukuking, a word I had not yet learned.
Bukuk in Yuktun is to eat tiny bits of meat that cling to the bone, which you patiently pick away at with your fingers.
At the end of the meal, my teacher, Annabelle, came to me and said, "Dakutun ka, you're done, aren't you?" And I thought I was, so I said yes. But she didn't look happy about my answer.
And as he looked around the table, he saw that everyone else was still bugooking their muskrat. So he did his best to copy them.
And with a lot of extra effort and noise, that's the Yupik word, bugooking, removing the meat from every little bone.
For Father Alexa, this was his first lesson in Yupik etiquette.
Waste nothing. You consume everything as a sign of gratitude and respect, even for the animals who have died to keep you alive.
It was the spirituality of living off the land that he shared in lectures across the state. And one of his last legacies, his work to canonize the Russian Orthodox Church's first female saint in North America, Matushka Olga, or Mother Olga, the wife of a Gweethluk priest known for her healing love, especially for abused women, a cause also close to Father Alexa's heart. In Anchorage, I'm Rhonda McBride.
And I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
New federal legislation has been filed to counter the growing number of book bans nationwide by classifying them as federal civil rights violations. A new report from PEN America finds there is a sustained campaign targeting titles written for teens and young adults, which include topics of racism or LGBTQ+ relationships. Catherine Carley has more.
New federal legislation would classify discriminatory book bans as violations of federal civil rights law. The Books Save Lives Act would ensure public and school libraries maintain a diverse collection of authors and would direct government officials to report on the effects of book bans on underrepresented communities. Democratic Massachusetts Congresswoman Ayanna Pressley says as a child who endured sexual abuse, she credits author Maya Angelou's often banned I Know Why the Caged Bird Sings with saving her.
It was the first time in my life I knew I was not alone, and it helped me move forward. So when I say that books save lives, I mean that.
More than 3,000 books were banned last school year, a 33% increase from the previous year. Backers of these bans say only parents should be able to determine the kinds of reading material their kids can access. A new report from PEN America finds the majority of titles banned from public schools and libraries include some topics often considered difficult, including racism, violence, or LGBTQ+ relationships. PEN America's Laura Schroeder says as a former high school social studies teacher, she's concerned about copycat bans in which titles are removed from an entire school district because another district elsewhere removed them.
And I know firsthand how much students deserve access to stories that reflect their lived experiences, but also stories that are different from their own.
While PEN America can track the number of book bans, Schroeder says the larger impact on public schools and institutions is harder to quantify. Supporters of the Books Save Lives Act say it will also help protect librarians, whose careers and personal reputations have increasingly come under attack as efforts to ban books grow. The bill has just been filed and hasn't been assigned a number. For Commonwealth News Service, I'm Catherine Carley.
A new bill would change tax laws, keeping the Internal Revenue Service from taxing a successful plaintiff on funds paid to attorneys in consumer fraud cases. Suzanne Potter has more.
Democrats in Congress reintroduced legislation this week to protect consumers who win lawsuits against big corporations from being overtaxed by the IRS. The bill would ensure people who win fraud cases receive the full amount of damages, rather than being unfairly taxed on fees awarded to their attorneys. While serving in the Navy, Mario Montemayor bought a BMW in San Diego 10 years ago for $30,000. The seller failed to disclose structural damage. He sued and won his money back plus attorney's fees. Then the IRS came knocking.
They already taxed my attorney on his winnings, and he said he paid taxes on his.
then the IRS comes back at me and tries to ask me for money on his winnings. So it's basically a double taxation deal.
The IRS demanded Montemayor pay $58,000 in taxes, penalties, and interest on the $162,000 that went straight to his attorney. This law would reverse a Trump-era policy that allows the IRS to tax plaintiffs on the full amount of the judgment in fraud cases, including money awarded to their attorneys. Opponents of the bill argue that it would incentivize more litigation and reduce revenues to the IRS. Senator Catherine Cortez Masto of Nevada is a co-sponsor of the bill.
People who win their cases can end up owing more in taxes than they actually receive in compensation. It's not fair. My legislation will end double taxation and keep more money in the pockets of Americans who stand up against fraud and abuse.
Montemayor says this has been hanging over his family for too long.
It's not just the actual financial aspect of it. We don't make a lot of money, but it's also the fact that the IRS is constantly asking for the money. It's stressful.
A version of the bill called the End Double Taxation of Successful Consumer Claims Act has also been introduced in the U.S. House. For California News Service, I'm Suzanne Potter.
Offshore wind is thought to be a great resource for clean energy. The Great Lakes region experienced a surge of excitement about it a decade ago, but where is it now? Farah Siddiqui reports.
Offshore wind development in the Great Lakes region has had a turbulent history and faced many challenges. Initially considered a promising location for offshore wind due to consistent winds and potential economic benefits, the Great Lakes and specifically Michigan have faced numerous setbacks. Despite early proposals and plans, no commercial wind turbines have been installed in the region more than a decade later. Doug Bassett, an associate professor at Michigan State University who studies the acceptance of renewables, says Michigan isn't any closer to ramping up this technology than it was 10 years ago.
A lot of policymakers are hesitant to get offshore wind attached to their name because it's such a controversial technology. I think people are afraid to kind of push it forward.
While floating wind turbines are a potential solution for addressing concerns about visibility and environmental impacts, offshore wind in the Great Lakes continues to face political and public resistance. Earlier this month, the Lake Erie Energy Development Corporation, or LEEDCO, made the decision to halt the Ohio project indefinitely. It was close to completion but faced strong opposition, and the U.S. Department of Energy decided to terminate its $50 million grant because LEEDCO's wasn't meeting performance milestones. Scandia Wind, a project in Grand Haven, Michigan, faced strong public resistance common to offshore wind projects in the region. Bassett says even if the turbines were so far off the coast that you couldn't see them, Scandia did not win public opinion. Now, without a specific project in the state, he says the overall industry faces obstacles, including public concerns and regulatory challenges.
We're moving forward on offshore wind in the Atlantic and increasingly on the Pacific as well. And a lot of those technologies that we'll need to deploy in the oceans do work in the Great Lakes.
Across the lakes in Canada, the province of Ontario imposed a moratorium on offshore wind, citing a lack of scientific research on the turbines' impacts. This story was produced with original reporting from Nicole Polak for Inside Climate News. For Michigan News Connection, I'm Farah Siddiqui.
A new bill would modernize the federal poverty line, making aid more accessible. That bill would raise the federal poverty line to bring it more in line with the cost of living, which would allow more people to qualify for federal aid. Suzanne Potter joins us again from California.
The House of Representatives is considering a new bill that would modernize the federal poverty line, which hasn't been substantially updated since the 1960s. Many aid programs, such as CalFresh, Head Start, and Medi-Cal, are pegged to the so-called FPL. And raising the maximum people could make would help millions more low-income families qualify for aid. Casey Peeks is a policy advisor with the Children's Defense Fund.
We're trying to make sure that the families who are not able to put food on the table and can't afford childcare are included in this definition of poverty so that they receive the supports that they need from the federal government.
The poverty line dictates who can and cannot get federal assistance. This bill would update the federal poverty line so that it more accurately reflects the cost of living. That includes things such as housing, food, clothing, phone, internet, and health care. It also considers whether a family has children and is regionally adjusted to consider things like the cost of rent or child care. Opponents say raising the federal poverty line would greatly expand the social safety net, which would balloon the costs. Peeks admits the bill has little chance of passing the current 118th Congress.
We also have to understand the realities of the House, which is currently Republican controlled. So even though it is unlikely that we will see this signed into law, this is something that is important to put a stake in the ground so that people are thinking about these things.
Peaks adds that California's relatively high minimum wage means some very low-income families may make a bit over the federal poverty line, so they may not qualify for federal assistance, even though the cost of living is higher here than in many other states. For California News Service, I'm Suzanne Potter.
You're listening to an end-of-year campaign edition of the KBOO Evening News for Friday, December 15th, 2023. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Please feel free to call or text us with your breaking news stories, tips, and ideas at 971-245-2158. Our producer and engineer for tonight's newscast is Althea Billings. Special thanks to Edwin J. Vieira, Farah Siddiqui, Trimmel Gomes, Catherine Carley, Suzanne Potter, and Antonio Gonzalez. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Michelle Coppola.
And I'm Josh Salem. All of our KBOO programs, including the Evening News, are supported by our members. KBOO is currently in our end-of-year campaign, so now is a great time to join. If you would like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Stay tuned now for Counterspin.